Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present ACLU attorney Henna Shamsi, who describes the constitutional flaws and lack of fundamental legal safeguards her group observed at the U.S. Military Commission trial of Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver. Jeff Halper, founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, who explains why two boats with 40 international activists on board will try to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. And journalist Dave Lindorf, who assesses Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Suskind's assertion in his new book that the Bush White House ordered the CIA to forge a document to create a false link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
13-year-old Adon Kalenga of the Democratic Republic of the Congo earns $3 a day by logging and cleaning rocks that contain copper and cobalt for a smelter owned by a Chinese company. Adon cannot afford the $6 a month it costs to go to public school in the war-torn Central African nation of 62 million people. According to the Bloomberg Newswire, 67,000 people in the southern Congo province of Katanga collect and deliver these valuable rocks to smelters, a practice that was halted in many industrialized countries in Europe over 250 years ago. The hand diggers, as they're called, work freelance for the smelting companies, and the metals end up in various goods, including cell phone batteries. In recent years, China has gained a reputation for investing in resource-rich rogue nations in Africa, like the Congo, Sudan, and Zimbabwe, to fuel its record economic growth. Yet the Chinese companies and cell phone giants like Nokia say child labor is wrong, and their contractors in the Congo deny using child laborers. 2004 Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai of Kenya says Chinese firms have a moral obligation to uphold labor standards since human rights are not respected in most African nations. During the oil shocks of the 1970s, Indonesian dictator Suharto used surging oil profits to fund education and social programs that helped fuel the Southeast Asian nation's growth in the 1980s and early 90s. Suharto was deposed in 1998 after the Asian financial crisis and died in January of this year. Today, Indonesia's status as a petrostate is in rapid decline. Indonesia became a net oil importer in 2004 and recently announced it is quitting OPEC. Oil production has fallen in Indonesia for over a decade, and the country has continually missed meeting its OPEC production quota in the face of historically high oil prices. According to the Christian Science Monitor, Western oil companies avoid investing in the Asian nation because of high royalties demanded by the government. Indonesia is also hampered by its reputation as a deeply corrupt country. In 2007, Indonesia claimed an estimated 4.4 billion barrels of oil in proven reserves, more than Asian rivals such as Vietnam, Malaysia, and East Timor. Indonesian President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono is in political trouble for cutting the oil subsidy twice in recent years, as the rising price of oil has put a major hole in the Indonesian national budget. He's also facing domestic criticism for backing off pledges to reclaim millions of dollars of Suharto's wealth, alleged to have been stolen from his country. As the Olympic Games are being held in totalitarian communist China, questions are being raised as to why someone in the United States would be subpoenaed for organizing an educational student trip to Cuba. Such is the case of Reverend Lucius Walker of IFCO, Pastors for Peace. On Thursday, July 31st, he appeared before a New York State judge on contempt of court charges. The charges stem from an investigation by the Special Commission of Investigation for the New York City Department of Education, headed by Robert J. Condon, regarding travel to Cuba by high school students. In a sit-down session with the New York City School Board, Reverend Lucius Walker refused to give names or answer any questions regarding the students who traveled to Cuba. Reverend Walker stated there were 2 to 3 student trips organized over the past 2 years with prior board approval. Now the board is charging that the teachers committed acts of misconduct by allowing the students to go to Cuba. Due to errors in paperwork presented in the court, Judge Judith Geisch refused to rule on the motion of contempt of court against Reverend Walker. In a subsequent meeting on August 7th, the Special Commission of Investigation requested the testimony be sealed. As a result, the contempt charges against Reverend Walker appear to be put on hold while the next hearing, scheduled for September 23rd, will address the motion to seal the testimony. For the past 20 years, Pastors for Peace, headed by Lucius Walker, has defied the U.S. embargo by bringing humanitarian aid to Cuba without the requisite license. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Chris Ferriero.
On August 6th, a jury of American military officers found Salim Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver, guilty of providing material support for terrorism. He was acquitted of the more serious charge of conspiracy. Hamdan, a father of two daughters from Yemen, was sentenced to a 5.5-year prison term the day after his conviction. With time already served in the U.S. Guantanamo Bay detention camp and elsewhere, Hamdan could complete his sentence in 5 months. But the Bush administration maintains that even after he completes his sentence, the U.S. has the authority to hold Hamdan indefinitely until the end of the war on terror. Mr. Bush wants to conduct 80 more trials of Guantanamo detainees. Human rights groups from around the world have condemned the Bush administration's military commission process at Guantanamo, citing the system's use of secret evidence, hearsay evidence, and evidence obtained through torture. Colonel Morris Davis, former chief prosecutor for Guantanamo's military commissions, who resigned in protest in October 2007, says that he had been pressured by political appointees at the Pentagon to pursue cases deemed sexy and of high interest, such as defendants charged with being involved in the 9/11 plot in advance of the 2008 elections. Davis, once a staunch defender of the military commissions process, wrote in a Los Angeles Times editorial, "I concluded that full, fair, and open trials were not possible under the current system. I felt that the system had become deeply politicized and that I could no longer do my job effectively." Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hannah Shamsi, a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union's National Security Project, who observed Hamdan's hearings at Guantanamo in December. She describes the constitutional flaws and lack of fundamental legal safeguards she sees in the military commission process.
I think that the verdict of history will show that this trial afforded an illusion of justice as opposed to real justice. Let's start with the fact that the system permits the use of coerced evidence, and Mr. Hamdan's lawyers had talked about the fact that some of the evidence against him was tainted by the fact that he was subjected to solitary confinement and sleep deprivation. The system also permits the use of secret evidence. In Mr. Hamdan's trial, the two witnesses who testified entirely in secret were ones that the defense put on, which seems a little bit counterintuitive until you realize what the government was using the secrecy provisions for. These were witnesses that now is clear from news reports were government employees, and the defense had put them on to show that Mr. Hamdan had in fact cooperated with the government. And it is that cooperation that the government seems to object to and would not let the witnesses testify in open court, and we therefore do not know the subject matter of the testimony, but clearly it must have played a role with a military jury who came back with a sentence that was a rejection of the prosecution's theory that Mr. Hamdan was the worst of the worst and needed to be put in prison for the rest of his life.
The Bush administration maintains that even after Salim Hamdan serves out the remaining 5 months of his sentence handed down by this military commission, that he could still be held indefinitely until the end of the, quote, war on terrorism, which we don't know when that may ever end, and maybe it will not in Mr. Hamdan's lifetimes or many generations to come. Tell us about your reading of this this Bush administration doctrine of indefinite detention, regardless of even the Bush administration's own creation, these military commissions.
My reading is that this is a doctrine that's entirely unsupported by law, most importantly, but also very significantly morality and ethics and the desire for effective counterterrorism. Because in all of these things, I mean, how much of a signal would you need to have that this system of justice is an illusory one than the fact that the government maintains that regardless of the outcome, it can still keep someone in prison regardless of what the jury finds? And as you said, the government maintains it can do so until the end of the so-called war on terror, which is undefined, has wide latitude, and as you said, could be several generations long. And that's part of the larger problem, which is the administration is taking positions that are actually counterproductive, that actually make us weaker instead of stronger. The strong thing to do would be to say, we have the best criminal justice system in the world. We're going to subject people to trial if there's evidence to prosecute them. And we're going to abide by the outcome because we trust in our institutions. We trust in what makes this country great. We trust in separation of powers. Instead, the message that is being sent is that we actually don't trust in the things that make us Americans and ourselves different from regimes which aren't governed by a system of laws, and we're going to create a secondary system which again is, you know, tilted towards prosecution. It's as if you have a fist on the scales of justice that lends itself to an outcome pro-prosecution, and even if that doesn't work, we're going to continue to hold people.
Where do things go next in terms of the objections of many here in this country to the military commission's process? Are appeals pending between the Supreme Court, which once rejected this whole process? And how can Congress step in here to change or abolish this current military commission system?
Well, you know, I have no doubt that appeals are going to take place in terms of the military commission proceedings, but given the issues and given the timing, it could possibly be years before appeals are heard, and you've got a final decision. Congress is in recess, and the number of days in which Congress is going to be in session before the elections are very few. But I think that it is just so important for people, nevertheless, to send the message to their representatives, as well as, you know, both campaigns, the political campaigns, that, you know, no more. This should not happen in our names. We should return. We've got alternatives. That's really the crazy thing. We've got alternatives that will restore credibility and that will restore America's status. For people against whom there's evidence of wrongdoing, there should be prosecutions in federal courts or, if applicable, military courts martial that we have. And if there are people for whom there is no evidence of wrongdoing, then they should be set free in accordance with U.S. law and its obligations under the international treaties that it has signed.
That was ACLU staff attorney Hena Shamsi. Contact the group at area code 202-457-0800 or visit their website at aclu.org. Sometime during the week of August 11th, two boats with 40 activists on board will try to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza, imposed in June of last year when the Palestinian faction Hamas took control of the territory and its 1.5 million inhabitants. The blockade has meant collective punishment for Gazans, which has taken many forms. The people in the most heavily populated area in the world have been deprived of fuel to operate hospitals and other essential services. Malnutrition has increased, and college students have been prevented from leaving to attend foreign universities. The boats and volunteers aboard the small flotilla are part of the Free Gaza movement, which includes former British Prime Minister Tony Blair's sister-in-law, Lauren Booth, Palestinians, Americans, including a Holocaust survivor, people from several other nations, and one Israeli Jew, Jeff Halper. Halper is a university professor and founder of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, an organization that rebuilds Palestinian homes that have been destroyed by Israel. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Halper as he was preparing to leave the Greek island of Crete en route to Gaza. He describes the origin of the project, the dire situation in Gaza, and what his group hopes to accomplish.
I'm sitting on the dock in Crete waiting for the boat, one of the boats to come in. So it has been a couple of years percolating, you know, because we have to raise money, we bought two boats, you know, there's the technical issues, the organizing, all that stuff. So now it's come to fruition, pretty much. In the next few days, I'm meeting the boats in Crete, and we're going to sail them to Cyprus to pick up the rest of the group and then head on to Gaza.
Who's on board?
40 people from 17 different countries. Among us is some Palestinians. You know, I'm unfortunately the only Israeli Jew. But there's an older woman who's a Holocaust survivor, Eddie Epstein from St. Louis. And so it's an interesting and diverse group of people.
Jeff Halper, are the two boats carrying supplies for the people of Gaza?
It's political. It's not humanitarian. And that's a very important distinction. We're there to break the siege. We're not a humanitarian boat. We're not Red Cross. We're not bringing foods and medicines or anything. We're a political boat that's going through to break the siege. Now, we also don't want to come empty-handed. So we're bringing 200 hearing aids for kids. You know, there's a big problem. Israel has a policy of letting loose sonic booms over Gaza as a form of punishment. Every 3 minutes, there's a huge sonic boom from the Israeli planes. And there's a problem of kids going deaf from the sonic booms. They need 9,000 hearing aids, but all we could afford was about 200. So we're bringing that's a symbolic thing. We're bringing the hearing aids just so we come with something. But the point of the mission is not humanitarian, it's political.
Just to clarify, you said the Israelis send those sonic booms every 3 minutes. What, around the clock?
Yeah. Not all the time, but they do it when they want to punish the population for something. Around the clock, it can last for days. Israeli planes, I don't know if you've ever experienced a sonic boom. It's really, you know, imagine 24 hours a day for 3, 4, 5 days a week. Every 3 minutes there's a sonic boom from an Israeli jet. So it's not only terrifying, and you can't sleep, it's a form of collective torture. But it also creates deafness, especially among kids. It's one of those realities of Gaza that nobody knows about.
One of the articles I read about your trip talked about the USS Liberty, which was bombed by Israel in the 1967 war, although virtually nobody in the U.S. knows about this. What's the story?
The ship was clearly an American ship off the coast of Israel. It was a surveillance ship. So the feeling is that Israel didn't want them to know what was going on. And they bombed it repeatedly. You know, even though it was clear that it was an American ship, 34 American sailors were killed, about 170 were wounded, and Lyndon Johnson gave orders immediately to hush it up, not to investigate it. There would be no report on it. It was absolutely closed,
the entire thing. And the truth has never come out, what really happened. You know, Israel claims it was a mistake and has apologized, but that simply isn't true. And the Americans have never, ever allowed any investigation. And, you know, the survivors are really furious. I mean, for years they've been trying to get an investigation. So we named one of the boats the Liberty in memory of that ship. And we got the note asking that we drop 34 roses in the water in memory of the sailors that were killed. I mean, it's a very good example of how Israel, you know, does anything it wants to do, including to the United States, and there's simply no price to be paid.
Are you expecting a military response from Israel, and are you in fear of your lives?
No. Israel has the right in international law to stop our boats and check whether there's weapons or not. That they can do, but then they should let us go on our way.
That was Jeff Halper, a member of the Free Gaza Movement. Contact the group's office in California at area code 510-232-2500 or visit their website at freegaza.org. Author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind reports in his new book, The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, that the Bush White House had ordered the CIA to forge a handwritten letter from the head of Iraqi intelligence, Tahir Jalil Habush al-Takriti, backdated to July 1, 2001, which stated that Mohammed Atta, the alleged coordinator of the 9/11 attacks, had trained in Iraq. According to CIA and other officials interviewed by Suskind, the order was a Bush administration attempt to portray a false link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda in order to justify the Iraq War. The forged letter was passed to a London Sunday Telegraph reporter in Baghdad, who wrote an article about it on the paper's front page of December 14, 2003, under the headline, "Terrorist Behind September 11 Strike Was Trained by Saddam." Suskind also claims in the book that the Bush administration had information from a top Iraqi intelligence official that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, intelligence they received in plenty of time to stop an invasion. The author maintains that such a covert operation to plant false information would constitute illegal White House use of the CIA to influence a domestic audience, an impeachable offense. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist Dave Lindorf, who, along with attorney Barbara Olshansky, co-authored the book, The Case for Impeachment, The Legal Argument for Removing President George W. Bush from Office. Lindorf assesses the new information in Suskind's book and the chances that the Bush administration will be held accountable for what many observers feel are numerous instances of abuse of power and violations of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, I think it's just another example that fits right in with other ones that we have already learned, that these guys were going to extraordinary lengths to get this country into a war, and they were willing to lie and cheat to do it. And it's totally believable. And in fact, there's more supporting evidence that's coming out with this, that not only did they forge this thing, but they apparently paid as much as $5 million to the guy to keep them quiet afterwards so that there wouldn't be a contradictory story coming out. And apparently there's a CIA agent who's testifying to its accuracy. So there's more than one source, and it certainly appears to be true. I mean, it lends a lot of credence to what I had written about in my book on the case for impeachment, about the clearly forged documents that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy 400 tons of yellowcake uranium ore from Niger, which also was ludicrous because, as I pointed out in the book, people that do illegal things, and that was hugely illegal under international controls over uranium, don't ask for receipts. You know, like when, you know, a drug dealer cuts a deal, they don't ask for a receipt for it. The documents were presented as the thing they talked about in the 16 famous words of the speech Bush gave as to why we were going to war, that we had learned from British intelligence that Saddam Hussein had tried to buy uranium ore from an African nation. Well, that was the basis for it, were these forged Niger documents, which were on stationery that had been stolen from a break-in in a Niger embassy in Rome, along with official stamps. So, and we know those were forged because the mining official's name, whose signature was put on it, had not been in office at the date of the documents. So they did a bad forgery. You know, here we are again. These are serious crimes. These are crimes of treason because they put the country into a war that is criminal and has destroyed the effectiveness of the military. I mean, it's a classic case of treason.
Do we know where Tahir Jamil Habush is, this Iraqi intelligence agent who supposedly was complicit in the forgery of this document?
No, I really don't know the answer to that. If I were him, I'd be in deep hiding right now.
Well, I don't think the Democrats will call him to testify. That doesn't seem likely, even if they could find him.
No, the Democrats are appalling in this entire thing. I mean, you would think that they'd be calling for Bush's head at this point, Cheney's head, but instead they're ducking and covering themselves. We know that the leadership in the House and Senate, Democratic leadership, is worried about being accused of being complicit in all this stuff because, you know, as leaders in 2002, Pelosi wasn't a leader then, but, you know, many of the other key figures, Rockefeller in the Senate Intelligence Committee and others, Steny Hoyer in the House Intelligence Committee, these were leaders who were briefed on a lot of these crimes. I mean, we know they were briefed on torture, and they didn't say anything about it. We know they were briefed on the NSA spying, and they didn't do anything about it. Didn't raise one fuss, you know, one word of concern. And so I think that there's fear among these Democrats that if they brought an impeachment case against Cheney or Bush, that, of course, the defense that they would fall on would be that, well, you guys did it too. You were part of it. We told you, and they'd probably have documents and tapes to prove it. Not that that justifies their inaction, because you know they could make the case that they weren't told the whole deal. They were told, you know, a little bit, and it seemed to make sense at the time. But they don't want to play that game. They're afraid, and so they won't stand up for the Constitution.
Is there the potential that the Bush administration will be held to account for its crimes against the Constitution and international law?
Not in this Congress. I'm pretty convinced, having been down to and watched the fake impeachment hearings that were held on the 25th of July in John Conyers' hearing room, it was clear that they were not going to let that go anywhere. But I do think that Cheney and or Bush, more likely Cheney, but maybe both of them, will be called to account if they ever dare to travel abroad after they're no longer in office, because at that point, any country with any guts or any willingness to take on the United States could indict them overseas on war crimes charges and bring them to justice overseas.
That was Dave Lindorf, co-author of the book, The Case for Impeachment. Read Lindorf's articles online at his website, thiscan'tbehappening.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.